happened there, and they didn't tell us that a couple of thousand of those.
2 years back or something.
Well, they were doing it.
Or last year.
Yeah, last year. And they didn't tell us that half of those students had facilities, or a third of those students had facilities furnished by the U.S. government elsewhere and shouldn't have been counted.
Well, I think the figure of one half is rather large. There are approximately, I think, 2,000 enrollments per semester on the military basis. However, some of those students also take some courses on campus as well, so.
Now, some of your students downtown take courses out on the base. I think that one washes, you know.
Well, anyway, what is the latest story?
Well, Chairman, could we afford to pursue that? Because I don't know of any request that that relates to, Clem.
Senator Crawford, I believe my question, please.
Sure.
We'll get back to that. In your backup material that you provided us last week, it stated that the university program needed general fund monies because you had a prep program that was lost. We since found that was not true. And then you said you had general fund monies existing, but you had never shown them in your budget. These evidently had come from internal transfers to surpluses. And we checked your budget, and it's true, you've never reflected any general fund monies used for the military programs in the past. Then, sometime this past week, you found $120,000, which evidently had been credited to the UAA account, and we were not aware of that. So you made the transfer, or you were going to request a transfer to the Board of Regents from UAA account to ACC of $120,000. That leaves $60,000 that evidently you still need for this program. In the past, as I indicated, you've taken the monies out of transfers and surpluses in the contingency fund. My question is, if it's only $60,000, why don't you take it out of the contingency fund again this year and reflect it in your 1979 budget as a program that we can consider and put them, have it reflected as general fund if necessary? And the last call that we got, I think it was on Thursday, we checked into it, was that you may have a $200,000 shortfall, which budget was it?
UAA.
UAA, if you don't get this supplemental. But you're not requesting $200,000 in supplemental for UAA. If you want $200,000 for a supplement on UA, you have to request it for that specific purpose and not take it out of some other program that we're passing on and make the transfer as soon as it passes the legislature. So I need to have some answers to those questions.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'd like to have you add. I think there's a, historical perspective here with the confusion related to this that might help the committee to understand. I'm not offering that as an alibi. I think you're going to see, and I'll ask Dr. O'Rourke to bring you up to date on that. But the problem begins with what I can only describe as the curious relationship that was set up between ACC and UAA as to who would do what in terms of military programming. And I think it begins there. Pat, if you could present that.
Committee would care to bear with that. It's about a two-page statement that I'd like to read through, but I think it would help place the whole thing in perspective. The history of the varying dollar requests that have come forward for ACC's military programs have been very difficult to trace. Part of the problem lies in the transfer of military programs from Anchorage Community College to the University of Alaska Anchorage, and then back again to Anchorage Community College. This was done by former Chancellor Lindauer over the past year. As a result, in some cases, the program was transferred, but not the dollars to go with it. In any event, for Anchorage Community College, it appears that the request for $182,000 for ACC alone was too large of a request to have gone forward with in the first place. However, if the military programs of both UAA and ACC are taken together, then it appears that the $182,000 request is too little. On the back of this, there's two financial exhibits. Exhibit 1 treats each unit separately, while Exhibit 2 would indicate the impact of what would occur if they were both treated together. This information has been provided by Stan Vaughan, Director of UAA Accounting Services. seems to have happened is basically this. In FY 77, the military program was budgeted and operated by Anchorage Community College. Budget identified as military total $428,200 in expenses and $445,000 in income. However, these budget figures were for the operation and administration of the military prep program, a non-credit program, and the income was actually to be received from the Veterans Administration through the student, and this income would have exceeded the cost of the program. Since the overall budget was balanced anchored at the Anchorage Community College level, the excess income was in effect used as a source of funds to operate the rest of ACC's budget, which included the credit instruction program for the military and was reflected in various expense accounts throughout ACC departments. The credit instruction costs for the military were not broken out separately, nor was the credit tuition income generated by the military courses broken out separately. It was wrapped up into ACC's total credit hour production and total income. The only thing that appeared separately was the non-credit prep program. Credit instruction on the military basis came from various instructional departments. Effective December 1, 1976, the Veterans Administration abruptly dropped the prep program, leaving ACC with budgeted income of $403,000, which could not be collected. ACC immediately took steps to curtail all possible expenses related to the prep program, including terminating the instructors. After these actions, there was still an approximate deficit of $234,800 in income shortfall at ACC. This deficit was absorbed by various and sundry cost curtailments in the rest of the ACC budget, including the contingency accounts that were spoken of. The effect of which means the general fund money was used to underwrite the military program. At the same time that this was occurring, former Chancellor Lindauer transferred the military expense budget from ACC to UAA, hired additional administrative staff person, and then overexpended the available funds by $222,800 during the balance of FY 77 by running unbudgeted courses on the military basis. This overexpenditure was offset by various cost curtailments in the UAA expense budget. In FY 78, the military budget was established by Chancellor Lindauer and in the University of Alaska Anchorage budget at $220,700, which consisted of $140,000 for administration and $80,700 for instruction. Additionally, $315,000 was anticipated in income from student fees. However, the expense budget contained only one full-time instructional position and approximately 52 part-time instructional salaries. These part-time salaries were entirely expended during July and August of the last summer, and generated only $15,600 in tuition income after the net of debt service. Effective for the fall semester of 1977, former President Ferguson transferred the authority to run the courses on the military basis back from UAA to ACC again, but he did not transfer any portion of the budget, either income or expenses. In fact, there was no provision to deal with the running of the military courses beyond the summer of 1977. It was around this time that the original supplemental request was prepared. ACC had just inherited the military programs again and was initially financing the credit instruction on the military basis from their various campus departments. Thus, the $42,000 requested, there were two items in the supplemental, if you recall. One was the $42,000 requested, was to replace the part-time instructional money, which was now being used for military programs, but was initially budgeted and intended for on-campus programs. It appears that the additional $140,000 should have been requested part from student fees and part from the supplemental, as long as it was going to ACC alone. If it was requested for UAA also, then there should have been a larger sum of general fund money requested. The only possible explanation I've been able to come up with as to why the $140,000 was requested from the general fund was due to the fact that income projections in late October and early November were not as accurate as those that were received in late January and early February. $120,000 revised request in student fees is not a transfer from UAA to ACC. It is income over and above ACC's budget. It is not currently budgeted in either of those units. So it's coming forward to the governor's office and LBA as new income. In addition, former President Neil Humphrey did not allow any further changes to be made in the supplemental after the final prioritizations were made in November. The Beginning with fall of 77, ACC utilized instructional funds from within its total instructional budget to run the military classes. Total expended through January 31st, 1978 is $93,770, not including administrative costs which were carried in the UAA budget. Total tuition received for these classes is $114,659 after debt service requirements of 35%. Inclusive of those spring classes, which people registered for before, but in, is spring classes, which people registered for before January 31st. Thusly, although the income looks larger than the expenses at the present time, the income includes some of the spring income, but not the expenses yet for the spring. In other words, a budget revision was submitted last fall to increase the military income and expense program by approximately $49,000. This was passed by the Board of Regents in December, and probably awaiting action by the governor's office and LBA. It has not gone forward from the university office yet. As of February 24th, an additional budget revision was passed by the Board of Regents for another $120,000 in tuition income expenses for ACC, which would be coming from the military programs. If the military budgets continue separately, ACC will require only $60,000 of general fund from the supplemental to complete the year. However, UAA will need approximately $200,000 additional general fund to offset anticipated net shortfall in military income, which cannot be offset by additional income from non-military tuition sources. Needless to say, the history of the problem is all very confusing. Most of it seems to lie in the transfer of the programs and the confusion surrounding the areas of responsibility for each of the units. As it currently stands, certain administrative costs are borne in the UAA budget, but they are not receiving any tuition income. Instructional costs are being carried in the ACC budget, and they are receiving the tuition income. Fact remains that for the entire military program in Anchorage to come into balance, $260,000 of general fund money will be needed between UAA and ACC. This was not the request that we went forward with. We went forward only with a request for ACC, and the sum of money which is necessary to cover their portion of the program is $60,000 from the general fund, plus tuition revenues that we've already had approved by the board. Also have a similar statement from Canada's President Stewart.
Senator Garcia.
What happens then, where is this $200,000 that UAA needs to come from? Is that a shortfall in to that institution?
Yes.
And why didn't you include that in the request?
I don't know. That was up to former Chancellor Lindauer to put forward a request, but those programs were under his control. I don't know why it was not included, Senator Rossini. We didn't know about it until just recently.
You see here, there's a... Can you define for me what an income expense is?
Where are you?
On the second page two there, as of February 24th meeting, an additional budget revision was passed by the Regents for $120,000 in tuition and income expenses.
That should be in tuition, income, and expenses.
Income and expenses.
Right. In other words, is ACC has maxed out at the amount of tuition that is included within their appropriation this year. A certain amount coming from tuition, a certain amount coming from general fund. They've come forward with a request for anticipated other tuition fees that they expect to receive in the neighborhood of $120,000, which is not budgeted. And they would be offsetting expenses for the utilization of that.
Are you asking now for $200,000? Is that a formal request for UAA?
No.
For the president.
No, because it's not clear in my mind as to what the $200,000 at this point, since I learned about this practically the way down. It's not clear in my mind specifically what it's for, and it's not clear in my mind as to how they intended to meet these costs, which apparently, from this explanation, were constant. How they intended to meet these costs without these costs without requesting the money. I don't know.
It's not clear to me either. Let me read the Budget Act at the beginning section under which the university falls, Section 4. If federal or other program receipts fall short of the estimates appropriated by this act, the affected appropriation shall be reduced by the amount of the shortfall in receipts.
In a second, I'm not sure how that specifically relates to the prep program last in FY77.
If you had a shortfall in UAA, of federal funds of any sort.
Program receipts.
Program receipts.
Not federal funds.
Either one, federal
either,
funds
either
or
federal
program receipts.
Okay.
Senator Steen.
Mr. I'm confused now as to what exactly is the status of various programs on the base schools and who has them and what their net is. President Stewart was here, President Stewart, or Chancellor, whatever, he's a community college, was here and told us that, in fact, the income from a given course on base is more than enough to cover the expenses of that course.
No, I'm not saying that.
Well, that's what he told us. Now, is that true?
Saying that?
Bill Stewart.
Depends on, you know, if you're talking about your administrative costs as part of the cost of that program, I don't believe that that is totally covered. If you're talking about the income generated for a single particular course, for the will that pay for the cost of that instructor, that's probably true. But your indirect costs for supporting that program, I don't think I believe totally self-supporting.
I understood it just to mean the total cost. Maybe that's incorrect. For upper division courses that are taught on base, who is responsible administratively for those courses? And where does the money go from this?
The UAA would be responsible for administratively, and the income should go to UAA for the preparation.
For a lower division academic course, who is responsible on base and where does that money go?
ACC, and it should go to ACC.
So contrary to the rest of the Anchorage campus, there's military bases. I understand you to say that all upper division courses go to UAA, all lower division academic courses go to ACC, even though in the rest of the campus, particular courses are divided among the two different ACC UAA campuses.
Right, because in late summer, early September, former President Ferguson returned the authority for the military program back to ACC again.
Military program, and that wouldn't include upper division?
No, but that's not within their mandate. They can't offer upper division. Everything except.
Dave? Mr. Dubal, I understood you say that this time you're not asking for an additional $200,000 for UAA, but are you intending to cover the $200,000 from the supplemental that's before us?
Dave, I don't know. I'm going to have to get back to UAA and find out the nature of the need for the $200,000. I don't know what it is.
Mr. Chairman, if I may complicate the life of the committee a little further. Friday night, the Regents approved a 2% budget reduction statewide. As I understand, it would be across the board at each BRU. That would be another $200,000 cut at UAA on top of this $200,000 shortfall. How do you propose to solve that problem?
Well, the Regents, the board passed an action which, as you indicated, directed me to set up a procedure to recover 2% at each BRU level. It was not an action which had the efforts of a number of people before the action was brought forward to figure out all the component parts. It was not a part of the agenda. It sprang from the discussion at the meeting. I spent this part of this past weekend with members of my staff, both Pat and Earl here, trying to figure out what exactly that meant, and superimposed on trying to plan for that 2% recovery from each BRU was Pat coming in to me on Saturday with the indication that there was a $200,000 shortfall at UAA as a result of the transfer of the military program. I have no answer to the question, Dave, as to I'm fully aware of the squeeze at UAA and what a 2% $200,000 recovery or $200,000 shortfall means.
I think it concerns me, Mr. Chairman. I said I understand that UAA reported the shortfall 2 weeks ago. It concerns me that the President only found out about it in the last 2 days. I would also be concerned that
could we find out if that's correct?
It was reported 2 weeks ago. I believe it was reported to Commissioner Allen and Ron Lynn in a meeting of university officials approximately 2 weeks ago, maybe it's a week and a half.
On the 16th, 17th? Surely.
The other concern I have, oh, excuse me.
Pardon me, Dave.
Would be the $60,000 for ECC, Mr. Chairman. If that 2% wasn't across the board cut, that would be another $140,000 cut at ACC. At the same time, we're providing $60,000 through this supplemental. I guess the key question, Mr. President, is that you're asking for $3.7 million in the supplemental. At the same time, the reasons are directed to cut somewhere between $1 million and $1.2 million from these same budgets. Why shouldn't the committee then be considering only a net supplemental, 2.7 or 2.5?
I indicated at the meeting, the Board of Regents meeting on Friday, that my understanding from preliminary word from the legislature was that they did not wish to have any part of the supplemental used to offset whatever mechanistic plans were afoot to try to compensate for the deficit. I made that statement at the board meeting, and primarily to get into the record the fact that if they were going to impose 2% across the BRU fiscal recovery, that it could not involve the supplemental for the obvious reason that you point to, Dave. I think while the right hand is requesting supplemental funds, I don't see much sense in the left hand requesting that they be reduced after they arrive here. I think that, so it would be my understanding at this point, assuming that they accepted what I said, was that it will not be taken from the supplemental.
Is anybody else confused?
Yeah, well, you lost
Attorney Croft.
I'd like to follow up on Dave's statement that the administration did know about that $200,000 at the University of Anchorage 10 days ago. Is that correct?
May I respond to that? I think we're getting confused between, some confusion between two units, so I'm just going to smack at it directly. That they consider ACC, and they asked for $182,000 in the supplement. In very recent time, as a function of revisions of their income, which is virtually into January, they now have, with better projections, come up with $120,000. So the difference is $62,000. That's out of the way. Now the $200,000 is being addressed in here that relates to UAA. There's a matter that did in fact come up when we were having a round robin session with all of the directors of administrative services to review a lot of things, not the least of which was their budget. When this matter relative to the $200,000 came up, it was indicated by the Director of Administrative Services at UAA that with the supplemental, he could make it through with certain curtailment.
But he was not getting any of the money, UAA.
You'll have to make curtailments in this transition between the two, is make curtailments within his overall budget in order to adjust, Senator, to the $200,000 shortfall.
So does that mean that somebody did know 10 days ago that they would have to take about $200,000, would take an additional $200,000 at UAA?
For supplemental purposes?
Yes.
There was no discussion of an additional supplementary.
And my question is,
because it could be accommodated, Senator, within the UAA budget.
Okay, now is it not certain that it can be accommodated? Or are you saying that it can be?
It can be accommodated down there in alignment with his original statement.
So you don't need $200,000 at UAA?
What you're addressing is $182,000 less $120,000, or a $62,000 differential. And that's it.
And you don't need $200,000.
Don't mix UAA into it.
You don't need $200,000 at UAA to continue the military program in Anchorage. Is that what you're saying?
I am saying that the ACC with the $62,000 differential can carry forth with their military program.
With their military program. I'm talking about the military program in Anchorage. All you need is a $60,000 appropriation
to ACC. You don't need an additional $200,000 to UAA, is that correct?
Right, with, if I can speak to that, Senator John. If you want to take military programs per se and say, are they coming in the black, that $60,000 will not do it. That'll bring ACC in the black. UAA will still be in the red by $200,000 on military programs. I think what Vice President Brewer is saying, throughout the overall UAA budget, they're going to absorb the $200,000 deficit. I don't know where they can.
Let me follow up my question.
Okay. What I'd like to know is, if we appropriate an additional $60,000 to ACC, then all of the military programs in Anchorage that were going on last month will be continued at that same level for the remainder of this fiscal year. And I can answer these telegrams that I've got here and these messages and say, if we add $60,000, then the legislature has done all that the university requests of us. And if those programs are cut, it's because the university has screwed up the administration of the programs, and it's not because the legislature didn't appropriate the money. Is that correct?
That would be correct. The answer would be off the legislature at that point. The fact of the matter is that there'll be the deficit of military programs. So.
The Administrative Services Director, if I might, told Dr. Brewer on Friday during the board meeting, and he came back to me, that this was contingent upon them getting their, the UAA getting their supplemental request, that they could then internalize the $200,000.
Okay, and they have a supplemental request with us now of $224,000
in the Senate bill. Yes, sir. I think the point, Mr. Chairman, if I may, is what I hear the university saying. They have requested $224,000 in their supplemental request for UAA, which is not identified for military base, but is identified for other needs at the university. What I hear them saying is that they will take 200 of the 224 and use it to cover the shortfall of military tuition rather than use it for the purposes previously identified.
What were those purposes?
No, no, Mr. Scott.
Oh, that's not true. Well, where are you going to get it from then?
Yeah.
By one of the things that Mr. Vaughn brought up was a curtailment in some of the summer school offerings, which would start summer school after July 1 instead of at an earlier date.
Excuse me, Earl, but those are the kinds of things that are identified in the supplemental for UAA. I'm pretty sure I'm correct.
For summer school?
I think so. Let's change.
Okay, the. Okay, it's for instruction, four-year graduate temporary instructional salary. It's February through June 30th. 60 spring semester courses scheduled. Is that it?
And 311 courses for fiscal 78 summer session as part of that request.
That's what you asked for, 224.7.
And that's the amount that's approved in the Senate bill.
You would, as the language indicates in here, if they didn't get it, they'd have to abbreviate the summer program. What I'm saying is that to make up the $200,000, they'll still have to abbreviate the summer school programs and start them subsequent to July 1 in the next fiscal year, as opposed to cranking them up earlier. That's the way he proposes to make up the $200,000 that was not requested in the supplemental.
You're saying that if he does get the 224, he will still fund the 60 spring semester courses, however, and absorb the 200 in the summer session.
Right. Okay, so it will be transferred or absorbed by the supplement request you presently have in. Senator Garcia?
Mr. Chair, I wish maybe you could explain to me why you feel it's appropriate to reduce the services of UAA by some $200,000, and yet at the same time, fully fund, apparently, with the supplemental, the services provided by ACC. Which is what you're doing by saying there's going to be a shift in funds. You're reducing the services provided by UAA.
Senator, basically, that's correct, giving it to you directly. Whether we think it's appropriate or not, what the facts are that are before us is that ACC has come in with a request for a supplemental. They now have uncovered $120,000, which has created no end of grief, which leaves a net difference of $62,000.
So they'll be taken care of, and everybody's happy with ACC.
Right. In the manipulations that have gone on, frankly, between program shifting between the university and ACC, which is only significant historically, is that...
Well, significant those students in the summer program who aren't going to have courses.
There will be some curtailments in that. That is correct.
Then why aren't you here asking to provide those services that the students apparently want and will use?
They're not requesting it because it can be absorbed in the method we've indicated, despite the fact that there will be some people affected by a lack of a summer program.
Well, they're the students we're talking about, at least the students I'm talking about, the university is supposed to be serving. You're saying we're going to keep the spring program, but we're going to cut the summer program. And that's how you're making up for the lack of request, which I can't understand why there's a lack of request.
Well, I think you find the university in a pretty much an untenable position, and that is, it becomes a rather interesting question to ask for $182,000 and then drop it down to $62,000 and then come back in with $260,000.
It's even more untenable, in my opinion, to cut services to the students who want them.
Well, cutting to what services, Joe?
Well, summer programs.
Well, what summer programs?
Come on. Give me a quick historical situation. What happened to the $200,000, according to you? How did you bump that up again?
The $200,000 is part of this material in here that was prepared by Stan Bond, which Senator Sackett is a function of taking the shortfall in the UAA and combining it. If you put it all in ACC.
No. How did it occur? How did you end up with $200,000 less? You took the 120.
Okay.
Give me a quick rundown. Military income expense, 200.
Senator Sackett.
Oh, okay.
If you would look at exhibit short two.
Okay, I have
exhibit number two, I think.
It was a shortfall, but you spent the money.
Yes. Or have it committed.
Okay, well, I understand you're going to be back down Wednesday again.
Yes, sir.
For the House budget. By the way, where are you on your budget for 79?
Also, I was related to Board of Regents action on Friday. The board passed the FY79 budget submission pending approval of changes to be made by the board's finance committee, which puts us in this position where all of the zero-based budget part of the fiscal 79 exercise was deemed to be faulty by the board at the Friday meeting. It was deemed to be faulty, and I'll try to be brief want more details, I'll try to provide them, but it was found to be faulty from the standpoint of a set of criteria, weighted criteria, which were applied against the priorities submitted by the units. When that was applied, two units of the university came in below the projected levels of zero-based funding, 90% and 90% and 95% of the base 100%. The two areas were the community college, BRUs, 14 of them, CES and REA, and also organized research. I assume the board's feeling from the discussion on Friday at their meeting had to do with testimony provided to them from Chancellor O'Rourke and others, that the weight of the criteria as they applied, at least in these two areas, were faulty, and in effect it punished these two areas and reduced their funding. The board then said, in effect, go back with those packages, reapply the criteria and weighting system so that it is more equitable, and obviously making it more equitable for community colleges and in the organized research components, it will roll back the figures or the validity of the figures in all other BRUs. So Senator Sackett, what we have, the only thing remaining intact are the two packages which in essence came down after approval by the board on December 2nd, which is the 70.7 and the 77.4. That's the decimated status of the 79 budget.
Sir?
Was the RP for the community college approved by the Board of Regents?
Yes.
Do you have an opinion as to when a budget the university will be ready?
The 79, the two components I spoke of are ready.
No, I mean an overall.
The overall, part of the problem, sir, is the fact that the very people that are necessary to be working on backing out those figures, for example, using Pat as an example, are here now. He's going back tomorrow to spend whatever time it takes for him to correct and work with his college presidents, community college presidents, to roll back the figures, so.
Do you have a target?
My target is next week, the end of next week. I think that's a dangerous target.
End of March is what you're shooting for?
Yes.
And do you think that's realistic, or by dangerous target, do you mean it's likely to be suspended?
Well, if I can get, to be as specific as possible, if I can get the budget development director, who must be here on Wednesday, Thursday and Friday, if I can get him back up there, if Pat can be there and get his community college presidents, who I anticipate will also have to have some time here on Wednesday, Thursday and Friday, the House Finance hearings, if I can get them working piecemeal and get the data together and up into the statewide office, hopefully we could make it by the end of next year.
Dear Pat, when are you leaving?
Afternoon, I'm at the call.
Oh, okay. You want to finish up?
Yeah, I was going to ask, do you expect the Regents to approve it before you submit it to us?
Yes, but.
And when's the next meeting of the board?
The motion that they passed, sir, was one where they approved the 79 budget at their regular meeting on the 24th Friday, pending subsequent approval by the Finance Committee of the board, pending the changes, which means that if the community college chancellor, Dr. O'Rourke, and the others who voiced concerns at the 24th meeting, if they are convinced that it's a more equitable preparation at this point, and so indicate to the Finance Committee of the board, the Finance Committee of the board will pass on the zero-based portion of the agenda of the new budget. So it will not necessitate another meeting of the full board.
But does it take a meeting of the Finance Committee?
Not necessarily for the two parts. Now remember, the two parts that I'm saying are already down here unacceptable were passed in the same fashion by the board. That, because there are no changes, I'm hoping to extricate from the total 79 budget, take that out, have them agree to pass that on down right now, effective Wednesday, and then convene them to review the other parts, which are the zero-based parts. And I bear with me on the confusion of this.
Okay, we have to turn. But could we meet 8 a.m. on Wednesday then to take up the university supplemental?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and then tomorrow I'd like to meet at 8:30. We have three bills, House Bill 104, which we did not take up today, a certificate of residency, Senate Bill 438, AFDC, and House Bill 439 related to longevity bonus. I passed out as a work draft copy of the longevity bonus. What we did was there's about five or six different bills on longevity, and just for your review, put them all together, and then you can take a look at them and start deleting and adding where you want. It's just a work draft, just to combine. Mr. Rourke.
The meeting of the Committee on the University Supplemental on Wednesday, do you need further information? Do you anticipate that you will need further information about that?
Sure.
Yeah, you might go back and find out about what's going to happen with the 200,000. See if you can absorb the 60,000.
Sure.
Don't add any more on. Yeah.
I'd like to have somebody from UAA, preferably the chancellor, come down and defend his own budget. We have the community college well represented here, and I don't see.
Who's chancellor?
Acting Chancellor Wolf.
My question is, he just got on too. Will he know anymore? And you know, as Vice President of Finance?
He is scheduled to be here on Wednesday. I can move him to, I can have him make certain he's in here early.
Right.
And he will have, he has already indicated that he's a little without all of the facts on the budget, and will bring his administrative services director.
Okay.
Chairman,
Senator Butrovich.
There's one question that has
has not been satisfied as far as I'm concerned, and that is the curtailment of one program to carry on another program, and are we going to go through the same hassle again with a different set of people when that program is when that program is curtailed? And that bothers me because what are we doing, just prolonging the agony till later? I want to know more about that. I'd like to find out who's getting shafted on a program that's being dropped to accommodate another program where the crisis is now.
Why the solution is always to drop programs?
What is that, sir?
And why the solution is for the university is always to cut back on instruction.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, it might be a good question to ask, Mr. Chairman. When the Senate committee was considering not funding the total supplemental, we got letters saying all classes would be cut. When the Regents make a 2% across the board cut, they say no classes will be cut. That's a very interesting dichotomy.
That isn't what they're saying today.
No, that's true. I've got some bills for signed, but I think they're tomorrow.
And the red money back.
House Bill 104, Certificates of Residency.
Senator Orsini, go ahead.
President, the chairman, the upper 104, pertains to means of identifying residents of the state as community subsidy states for purposes of hiring under Alaska Statute 3840, which is the oil and gas lease related jobs. The differences between the community subsidy and the original House bill are basically two. One of them is to reduce the fee for a certificate of residency from $10 to $5, and the secondly to remove references to AS 36 as requiring a certificate of residency. Even 3840. The department, as I understand it, does have one suggested change, which seems to be a reasonable change, namely on page 1, line 13, deleting the language after the $5, that is, not allowing a waiver for hardship cases. I think the basically the thinking is twofold, one of which is that if the person is using this to get a job, that certainly be able to afford the $5 from the job. Secondly, the cost to the state of going into the background investigation required for the waiver would certainly exceed the very costly investigatory procedure, and $5 isn't all that great amount of money for a person getting a job for the state. Department of Labor?
Yes, sir. Dale Chief, Mr. Chairman, I'm Director of Wage and Hour Division. I was with the division last year when this bill was introduced, but it's basically a program to seek generating bail and provides for some penalties for counterfeiting and that sort of thing. A little bit of background, the department attempted to prosecute someone who was counterfeiting and selling cards last year for several hundred dollars or $1,000 a card, and tried to prosecute him under the existing statutes. And his defense was that he had told the people he was selling the cards to that they were counterfeit, so the court ruled that, and rightly so, so we needed some law there, I think, in that area. We're still picking up, not to the extent that we did during the construction of the line, but we're still picking up people with forged and altered and counterfeit cards. And they are valuable now, even probably more so than they were during the construction of the line, because of the fact that we probably have 5,000 to 7,000 jobs now with a lot of people trying to get them.
Questions? Senator Garcia?
I didn't realize this attempt of prosecution. Can you tell me that if I have a $10 bill that I tell you is counterfeit but give me $5 for it, that's legal as long as I tell you about it? Is either one of us to be prosecuted for it?
Not money.
This is a little different, sir.
I guess it is. That has nothing to do with it. I'm just curious.
Any further questions? Senator Garcia.
I don't know how to avoid this, but it Section 134A2 says that in essence, a bureaucrat can say, this card is fraudulent, and take it away from an individual. As I can read the statute at least, there's no finding of fact or anything else that would require some bureaucrat for whatever reason to take away a person's, in essence, ability to work.
We have the procedures, and they've been refined. We're currently advertising regs that will define it and refine it even more. But we do have a hearing procedure, Senator Orsini, by which an individual with a fraudulent card is given an opportunity to give testimony, and then there are findings of fact, and he can appeal that to the commissioner and then on up.
There is a hearing procedure?
Yes, sir.
These are proposed regs or adopted regs?
We already have some, but we've refined them this year even more so. And I don't have a copy of it. I didn't realize it was going to come up. But they're being advertised now. I think the hearings are on the 14th of March in Anchorage in person.
Okay. Any further questions?
Yes, Mr. Senator. I'd like to ask Senator Orsini what the AS-36 bid was.
Mr. Chairman, the AS-36 is the public contract section of the statutes that requires the state and municipalities to, in essence, locally hire for public works type contracts. The department apparently felt that this is a questionable legality and didn't wish to push the issue. May have some right. That was basically the reason for the relation to that reference. The government submitted that one. That's why I wondered. Maybe
we don't presently, Mr. Chairman, we don't presently certify or issue
certificates of residence to individuals coming under Title 36. We do a weekly payroll audit, and their residence is established by that means. I wasn't here when the bill was introduced, nor any of the prior hearings, so I don't have any history on it. But it would be extremely difficult to administer that under Title 36 because we aren't presently certifying those people in front.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, but I don't understand the explanation.
Try one more time.
Individuals employed under public works contracts under Title 36 are not now required to possess a certificate of residency as they are under Title 38. We do a weekly payroll audit of each contractor to ascertain whether or not he is maintaining the required level of residence under Title 36. This bill apparently was contemplating resident cards for those individuals too, which we don't have any machinery set up for it now to either certify those people, I'm sorry if I can't explain any better than that.
Mr. Chairman, is there some particular reason why they should be exempt? I don't know.
Except for the fact that there's no provisions now to certify them before they become employed, as it is in Title 38.
But, Mr. Chairman, before we passed this act, it didn't the same thing apply to everybody else, didn't it? I mean, what's the difference? Until we pass the bill that we're amending now, didn't the same situation exist that exists for the people you would exempt under the substitute bill? Everybody?
Well, I suppose so.
And you managed to cope with that. I suppose you do. I just don't understand why you exempt a certain class of people. To me, it'd be just as easy to check on them as it would be to check on anybody else. You say you go through the payrolls anyway.
It's after they're employed. I think that probably the one reason is that under the present procedures, we're not aware of who's on that job until after the first payroll comes in. It could be worked the same way as Title 38, but it would bring a lot of people in that are not here before under the Certification Act.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just thought the idea of the bill was to assure residency to hire. And if you exempt a certain class from that, don't you partially defeat the purpose of the Act? So you have to hire a couple more people. You've got them running out of ears now. You more won't make any difference.
Certainly.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, though, about the idea of telling municipalities. John, see, 36 also covers the municipalities.
I don't know why we shouldn't.
That makes sense. Public works, so it would be state projects like construction of buildings, etc.
That's right.
So they should have residents.
The law requires 95% now, as long as there's no federal money in there. I really can't answer, Mr. Chairman, why it was deleted last year because I wasn't here then. I don't know the.
Okay. Well, we passed the bill about 5-6 years ago that says that if they don't comply with that law, we withhold our funds. The only question is, do we not enforce it? That's the question.
Do you enforce that one through the payroll instead of with cards?
Yes, sir.
So they are checking to see that they.
We.
I don't know the instance in which funds have ever been withheld from the municipality of Raleigh.
Mr. Chairman, it also applies to preliminary surveys, engineering studies, consulting,
in addition to the moral construction activities, this all applies to the pre-construction activities. The fact that I asked the department last year, 2 years ago, I'm wondering where it applies.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
That's okay, I'm enjoying it.
Go ahead, that's what he always wanted to be.
That's all I'm glad to get, is a mistake once in a while.
As far as I'm concerned, the only way I'd ever put this out would be without recommendation, unless we have someone from the AG's office in here and tell us there's some compelling reason why we shouldn't have AS 36 in there.
No, I think we'll send it back to subcommittee, research that, and if there's no compelling reason, then the AG and the committee substitute.
Mr. Chairman, could I get the committee on the deletion of the hardship waiver?
No, I don't have to ask
the question.
We had a situation like that during the construction of the pipeline, but in most cases,
we're not going to hit the point on our
Most cases, they through Kamachis or something, they paid for their $5.
Yeah, the original bill that came down from the governor included Title 36. Who removed it? The Labor and Management Committee? So it was originally came down from the governor. It was the way you wanted it, John.
Well, that's right, but I'd like to hear from the AG or the governor's office or somebody that prepared the bill, or they must have had some legal advice, I hope, when they prepared the bill for the governor, and I'd like to hear them hear what they have to say about it before you delete it.
Well, you need the Labor and Management Committee in our House deleted, or in the House deleted.
I know, but that doesn't make it good necessarily.
Well, I don't see what the AG's.
Mr. Chairman, I find some notes here on the original bill requesting definition of residence under Title 36. It's pretty well defined in Title 38, but as I recall, Title 36 is not that well defined. That could have been the problem. I wasn't here last year, so I can't say.
Okay. Senator Orsini will research.
Let's make it simple. You know, a resident is one of the four.
Okay, longevity bonus, whatever that number is. 238.
Senate bill?
House bill, 238.
House bill 439.
Damn, I'm not going to listen to you ever again. House bill 439. Okay, there were six different bills in the House and the Senate. There was two having to do with money. One was to bring it from 125 to 150. The other one was, I think, by the governor to put it on a cost of living situation. And then I ran into a problem with my area having to do with persons with unregistered births. The law as it states now has two requirements. That you're born up, that you're 65 years old, and that you've stayed up here for a certain length of time. The problem that arises is that the criteria, an affidavit signed for make sure that you stayed up here for a certain length of time, are pretty easy to assign, but the age requirement is extremely difficult, especially with people that were not born in hospitals, which is most of my area. And you might go into further with the problems you saw in that.
Okay. In researching it, what we attempted to do in this draft committee substitute is address the problem of the person who applies for longevity bonus and does not have a registered birth certificate. As it stands. As it stands now, if a person applies for longevity bonus and does not have a registered birth certificate, the Office of Vital Statistics and Health and Social Services is supposed to research the person's local area records, etc., to come up with a delayed certificate of birth. I was informed that a quick instance of this being done would be around 6 months, but it could take as long as several years. Meanwhile, the bonuses can accrue for only 2 months. So that if a person is actually 65 at the time they start researching for his delayed certificate of birth, he's out whatever benefits he might have been paid until his certificate is actually issued. And so what I attempted to come up with in working with legal affairs on the committee substitute was a provision which, when a person does not have a registered birth certificate, would at least allow for payments after a period of vital statistics being able to research it for 60 days if the person provides an affidavit and the affidavit of three other persons attesting to the fact that he is 65 years old.
What problem did you run into with residency in terms of the issue?
In terms of the residency requirement that a person has to have had 25 years of continuous residency starting on or before January 3, 1959, the only proof a person is now required to provide for that is the affidavit of three people that he has in fact been here that long. And so it seemed to put a larger burden upon the person who might have been born here without a birth certificate than the person who might have come into the state at some period of time in the past.
Mr. Chairman, could we have Mrs. Swanson
sure.
to ask questions?
Yeah, go ahead, whoever you want. There's other parts of it too, by the way. One having to do with people that go out for hospital care.
That one I'm aware of.
Yeah.
And also Bill.
Go ahead.
On her, what she's talking about as far as the birth certificate. Many of them don't have birth certificates, but we do work with vital statistics. We have worked ever since the beginning of the program. First, we see if they don't have a birth certificate, we ask them if they're under Social Security. Social Security also verifies their birth date. And then if we find they are not under Social Security, then we ask vital statistics. As a rule, when someone I find doesn't have a birth certificate, I call vital statistics and ask them if they have a case going on somebody, and if not, if they have anything in their records. I would say that the average case that we have usually is from a month to 6 weeks. If they're in an area, some areas are, they need to keep records as well as other ones. Then they have to research it. They go through the census, federal census, through their schools and this type of thing, and it does take longer. But we don't have that many that we go on. In fact, I don't know when we've had one that's gone 2 years. Usually they go, I would say, from a month to 6 weeks, sometimes a couple of months.
This is a month if they do not have a birth certificate?
Yes, by time vital statistics, if they have anything at all. It will take time if we can't find where we can't locate where they've been living. Where we have most of our trouble, and I think you'll find when you talk to vital statistics, is someone that has been born into a family, and maybe that family died, and then they went into another one where it was hard to keep track of these people. But we don't have that much trouble, really, of getting people's birth certificates. I know there's a lot of chit-chat that we do, but we really don't.
Do you want to name one recently to remind you? Charlie Carlo?
Charlie who?
Carlo? Ruby?
Right off my head, no, I can't.
Okay, well, I just worked with him last year on a situation that it took him a year and a half to get his longevity after he turned 65.
Well,
first, he didn't have a birth certificate, so he was born out in a tracking camp. And there was only one person
that knew when he was born, and that is the lady from Rampart. And so he got her affidavit, and that was about 6 months after. And then he was under Social Security, and Social Security determined that he was dead. They got him mixed up with Frank Carlo, who was his brother. And so he automatically lost his longevity after he got it. And then it took him another year after that to prove that he was alive again.
Well, I'd like to take, into that
evidently, case. You take Social Security's word, you know, if they say they're deceased, and automatically you stop yours. But that's just one example.
Well, if we had that, I'm sorry, Senator, but I don't remember. Because I don't remember ever taking anybody off because Social Security said they were dead.
Okay, well, check your records.
I would
he
like
was.
To.
Anyway, we got it back on. It was about a year and a half.
It took.
But that's just one example of situations I have.
Well, it could be. I'm not saying it isn't. I just don't remember it because we're pretty careful about taking someone off the program unless we have something to show that they are deceased. And Social Security wouldn't have any reason to contact us on death because we don't work with them on death.
Well, he lost about a year and a half because of that. He lost Social Security, too.
Well, did somebody at the post office return a check marked deceased?
No. What happened was that they got his birthday mixed up with his brother's. And then his brother died about 5 or 6 years ago. And so he got a letter saying that he was no longer eligible because of that.
That you were dead and you don't
you
count anymore.
Back. If you don't pay back, you're going to be in trouble.
Big trouble.
Big trouble.
First known case of taking it with him.
The situation that I found, and that's just one example, I have an aunt that's run into the same problem, but they think now that she may have records down at Mulatto, which is the only place that they kept records in our area. There's about 10 villages surrounding there. Because they had a Catholic church there. And so the Catholic church would show that she was baptized down there. But they're in the process of getting that now. But she's already turned 65.
Well, we work real close, I know, in the lotto. I write to any place that I think that we can possibly find a birth certificate, whether it's a church or a registrar, anything like this. We actually do anything that we can to try to get a birth certificate or a baptismal certificate. And I know biostatistics can tell you how they work, and that I really don't think that we have that much trouble getting people on the program.
Well, I happen to think that there are problems. Ever since it was started, there have been problems of people who do not have birth certificates, and I'm not saying there are that many. But it sure works a hardship for the people that don't have it, because they are the ones that have to prove that they are alive and 65 years old. And it comes next to impossible because they have to obtain the documents to prove that they are. And for a lot of them who don't understand it, it becomes very difficult. And I think, in terms of how the law is written now, that a case could be made with regard to civil rights or discrimination because a certain group of people do not have birth certificates or baptismal records. And unfortunately, that group of people happen to be Alaskans who are Native. And it's much easier for a person who is from outside the state, who was born in a hospital, to obtain a longevity when all they have to prove is that they've been up here for a certain length of time. It's easy for us to prove that we've been up here for a certain length of time, but it's hard to prove when you're not born in a hospital. I wasn't born in a hospital, and that wasn't until I was 14 years old that I had to get a birth certificate. And the only person, that was just about 15, 20 years ago, only person that was alive was my aunt who delivered me, that knew exactly what year it was and everything like that. So as young as I am, you can imagine what it's like for a person who's 65. There'd be nobody around that delivered them or was there when they were born.
That's the problem that we're facing right now. And even if it takes care of 5 or 6 people, I don't think it works that much of a hardship on the administration to follow a different procedure. Senator
Julia? I'm wondering, I think it's reasonable enough to address it, even if there's a few people, John. I'm just wondering if there's any way that the check can be issued and held till the proof, because I realize how difficult it'll be to get that money back if you ever issue it, and then after the check is made, you find the person is not qualified. So maybe what we need is something that modifies that 2 months holding to where they can go through this system, but that the check is issued but held till the final proof is there, so that if it takes several months to get the proof, they're not losing their bonus, but they aren't having the check issued to them till they actually prove they're 65 or older. Because otherwise, you're going to be in the position of somebody was off a year and they're only 64, and suddenly you're going to go back and try and get your money back from these people. Well, it's, you know, if you're willing to go through the brutality of nothing being issued after they're 65, but you're just going to end up with a lot of uncollectible checks that were issued. That's all I'm looking at, John, is I don't want to ever see anybody that was under 65 get it.
Okay, what area is that that you would hold it?
Page 2, C. In other words, as soon as the affidavits are received, they have to be paid, even though the validity of the affidavits have not been checked.
Okay.
And so, this way here, the person would eventually get their funds. There wouldn't be anything like you were talking about. But that it still would allow the department.
All it says is that if a person whose birth is unregistered is otherwise qualified, shall receive a bonus at the beginning of the month next following early and is received for 60 days after the state register or by the certificate requested to investigate the birth. Give out a certificate for 60 days. If she says what is correct, then it shouldn't be any problem. But for people that go for a long period of time, we're kind of forced by the statistics to get on the ball.
And that's what I understood, Quinn. But if you read C and E together, and I understand it, if the department has reason to believe, some written reason to believe that they're not 65 years of age, then they don't get the check. They don't have to pay the check. If it later turns out that the person is in fact qualified, you still don't get the bonus as of the date of the application. You get it as of the date of the qualification.
Isn't that right?
Retroactive to the date of application or the date that he was qualified, whichever is later. But in other words, they do give vital statistics 60 days to come up with some proof that the person is not 65 years old.
Yeah, I understood that if vital statistics can't, within a 2 month period, come up with some proof that they're not 65, then they
start getting the check from you.
If they have provided the affidavits.
Yeah, if vital statistics in that 2 month period does come up with some type of proof, then the person does not immediately get the check, and if it subsequently turns out they're entitled to them, they get them from the date of the qualification, not the date of the application.
Well,
the date of the application or qualification, whichever is later. In other words, if the person applied in May of a year, but actually it turns out that he wasn't 65 until July, then his payments would be retroactive to July, in other words, the date he was qualified. If, however, he turned 65 in March and applied in May, then his payments would be retroactive to May, the date of his application.
Well, I'm looking at also at D. Why is the, you must contemplate the check will be paid without final proof being in, or there would be no need for D.
There's always that possibility under any circumstance.
Oh, no doubt about it.
I think there's a possibility of existing at all like that.
Yeah, I'm to solve John's problem, I'm not really upset. I just don't want to leave a loophole where we have to start issuing checks before the final proof is in. You know, and when they, you know, vital statistics say they have no record on the person, and you have to start searching elsewhere. Well, I can see it taking more than the 60 days, and I can see under this you have to start issuing a check. Well, if you don't have some real grounds for, you know, that the person isn't 65.
Oh, we thought so too, but I'm just taking Ms. Swanson's word that it takes a month to 6 weeks.
That's on average. Excuse me, Senator, but on average. May I suggest, Mildred is here from Vital Statistics, and she could probably explain her way a lot better than I can.
Fine.
You want to sit right up? Maybe you stay there, Marie, because I need some other fun.
Yeah, we had talked to you, evidently Ms. Judy had talked to you about your responsibilities.
Yes,
go ahead.
Shall I introduce myself?
Yes.
Mildred Richardson, I'm with the Bureau of Vital Statistics, and I've worked with the late birth registration for the past 8 years. I'm with the Native Land Company also. We did all the research for them on race and land coverage. I've also testified at all the hearings for people who are being disqualified from the rolls. So I'm familiar with the cultures. Senator, I would like to say on your comments about 60 days, this puts an awful burden on the Bureau to, with other responsibilities of people who are applying who are not 65. It's not reasonable because there just isn't enough time. If you happen to be born in a geographical region where the Bureau has many records, like you mentioned the lotto previously, we have most of the records right in the office for the lotto, because we're constantly collecting records from all the churches and anyone who will give them to us to cut down on the amount of time that it would take to issue a DA birth certificate. But as you know, most of our Native people were not born in a hospital, were born in remote areas. But when there is no birth certificate and there is no baptismal record, and there are many instances where villages have none of those, we have to turn to the federal census. And that takes us a month just to get a response from them. So 60 days would not be even reasonable in our working with this, because if, suppose the federal census takes 5 weeks, and it's not uncommon for them to do that, and we would be lucky to get a positive response, because the success of getting this particular census depends not only on the surname, as you're aware of, with the Eskimo people, there is not a common surname, so spelling, and where the people were living at the time the census was taken. I would say most of the time we are successful in getting the census. However, the length of time is considerable. So when we're looking for documents, if we don't have a school record, we don't have a baptismal record, we do try to go to other documents, but we are following national standards on the birth certificates to give the people the best possible proof for that certificate so it would not be challenged at a later date. Now, in prior years, they issued a delayed birth certificate on affidavits. And we have found that, I would say, 90% of the affidavits are in error because of many difficulties with the affidavits. So we don't try to use them for the basis of our information in establishing a birth certificate. We will use one affidavit, depending on who the person is that is supplying the affidavit. But affidavits are a big difficulty for us.
Senator Holmes,
I'm curious. I talked to the Bureau of Indian Affairs for 4 years, and every winter we were assigned the task of updating the village census records, which a practice had gone on for years prior to the time that I joined the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We had to list birth dates or the fish camps or where other people were, and list was their figs. Those records used as a source of information?
Yes, Senator, they are. We do use the BIA censuses. As you are aware, we have them up to 1962. They're sporadic after that. However, there are many villages where, because of population, censuses were not taken. If it was a very small group of Native people, they did not go in there and take censuses. So, again, you're hitting a minority where they're, because of a small group or a very small village, there are no censuses for those villages. Many times, the census takers went to the most knowledgeable person in the village, and he gave the total information of people that appear on that census. It doesn't always happen to be correct. So we found in our working with the censuses, while we use them as documents, that the information on the documents aren't always correct. No, people gave to what their knowledge was at the time. Yes, I know Charlie was born at such a time, and that's the date they gave. And they're not always, they're in conflict with some of the applicants' information as to what they believe. And most times we try to give the applicant the birth date that he believes is the most. Sometimes our documentation is in much conflict with what the person has been told about their birth. And it's difficult to make them change what they have been told.
What would you recommend? The present system from the other side is an awful slow process.
Well, our recommendation, to be fair to everyone, and I don't know who it would be in conflict with, would be to make the payments retroactive, as Social Security does. In other words, if we have established that a man should have been receiving this benefit 2 years ago, is to go back and pay him, because in all fairness, he should have gotten it. And Social Security has such a provision. Now, I don't know what the state has. This is from our point of view. I don't know, you know, who that would be in conflict.
Well, that would be fine if he was alive to receive it after that, but the problem is, as is coming out now, is the fact it takes an awful long time. I think something has to be in there to speed you up.
Well, if you have the answer, Senator, we would appreciate it, because we've been looking for it for years.
You
now, any
ways
and means that we could speed it up, we have tried. Because we are the advocate for the person. We collect all the documentation. We don't ask them to get anything except to complete the application and give us the information. Now, we have a lot of difficulty, as you know, with Native people, where they have been adopted by Native adoption. This is difficult. Sometimes they don't tell you this. You have to go out and try to retrieve this information. Because of cultural reasons, they don't volunteer. This makes our work very difficult and time-consuming, because we have to constantly go back and get information from them. Most of the times, they have it. Sometimes it could be lack of understanding as to what we are asking them. This, we try to work with the Native corporations, with anybody that's in the village who would help. We've done, we're the advocate all the time.
How long does it take on an average for you?
I would not like to say there's an average case, because each birth certificate is as individual as the person. If it's a geographical, say, take Kodiak, for instance, we can most likely do their birth certificates in a very short period of time, because there are good records in that area, and registration was good there. If it's an area that had, did not have good registration, or where the church records are not there any longer, I would have to say it takes us longer. So we don't can come up with an average. It depends. If you want to talk about geographical, I can give you ideas of how much longer it would take.
Okay, Bethel area.
In the Bethel area, I would say this takes a little bit longer, depending on what church records are available and what church the people went to. Of course, you know, what was then and what is now is entirely different, and the age of the document. This is not too difficult an area, although much longer than some other areas. I would say maybe 3 to 6 months.
That's a person that doesn't have any record. You know, if you come up, if somebody has already established Social Security, that's no problem. The Social Security is the proof. It's just the person who doesn't have a Social Security, doesn't have a record, and they can't really find out whether they existed 3 to 6 months.
Most
so
times we have one document. We may have one document in the Bureau. We either have the BIA census, we have all of those. We may have the school record. We have all the school records from the state of Alaska that exist. We have all of the baptismal records from the Russian Orthodox Church. We have most of the Presbyterian, the Episcopal Church records. So if we happen to have a record, it could be a short period of time. It just depends on the person. Now, we have many families who were baptized into one church, and then we'll have a member that is applying for a birth certificate. We don't have a baptismal record for that person. We don't know why. We don't know what happened to the record. The church doesn't know. So it's this type of thing that does take a long time.
What's the longest you've had?
Years. sometimes when a child has been given away, we've had cases where it's been difficult to prove because no one in the family will come forward and say, yes, this was a member of my family, yes, they were given away culturally for whatever reason, and it's been difficult to tie that person to the, back to the family. We've had some cases like that, not very many.
Does a baptismal record contain the date of baptism or the date of birth or both?
Well, the Russian Orthodox records contain both, both the date of birth and the date of baptism. Most baptismal records contain both dates. Yes.
Seems to me to be, you know, why would we have to string it out? Why don't we have an old person who claims to be 65 or older. Maybe the person's only 63. Why don't we require a judgment as to birth date immediately if that person's in need of the funds? Can't we do that?
What do you do if the person has died in the time they verify and you find that he died at age 64? How's the state get their funds back?
Why do we have to worry about getting their funds back? We want to look at the justice of the situation.
The justice of the situation is everybody else.
I need to interrupt you.
Okay.
Finish.
Well, if you give it to one person that's 62 or 63, then you have robbed everybody else that's 62 or 63 that should get the same treatment.
Well, how about robbing the person that's 65 and dies when he's 68 and he still doesn't have a birth certificate and never did get paid? Doesn't he have a right?
He does, and the thing is, but I'm not arguing, you've got a real problem. I'd feel much better if they got all their back pay, you know, rather than just 2 months. I think they're entitled to that.
But
the thing is that you do have enough that actually apply thinking they're 65, and when the records come in, they weren't. And I hate to see somebody paid that didn't deserve it. George, how do you work that out?
Well, all right, now to go back, let me finish my statement. What's the life expectancy of the white in this state?
About 75, I guess.
What's the life expectancy of the native in this state?
I don't know. About 70, 69?
About 50, what is it?
It's in its 40s, yeah.
No, not take the children, take
life
the children out, and then you have, it looks a lot better. Once you get to 30, which is the way they figure our life expectancy of the white, their life expectancy is about 69, I believe. But that's still,
There is a difference, right?
Is a difference, no argument.
Yeah, all right, then I think that if you're going to make both racial groups adhere to the same kind of age requirement, that you're building in an injustice in the system. And I don't know how to correct for that, but I'd suggest that if you find an old person in need, and there's some belief that they do that they are 65 and qualified, you pay them. If you find out that they're only 63 a couple of years down the road, you write it off. You don't worry about getting your money back, because you're more concerned about taking care of a person in need.
Aren't you? Yeah, this one is.
Or to correct your equity, your equity, can't do that.
You can withhold payments.
Human Rights, by the way, did propose that they sue the state on longevity based on the fact that Native people don't live to be 65, and therefore it was discriminatory, but I said, disregard that part. All we want to do is that if we get up there, that we don't have such a hell of a difficult time trying to prove you're alive in 65. And the present system is not working. You've heard how long it takes. And
there's
a lack of understanding. You know, a person who's 65 in the village, many of them just don't understand all of the requirements that are necessary by the statistics. And that's the difficult part. They'll get a letter, then they'll get another letter, and another one on top of that, and it's up to them to prove that they're 65 years old. And many of them don't know how to do it. And you know what correspondence is like with the bush? We don't ever see anybody from vital statistics out there. It's all by mail. The present system is not working.
For the comment?
Certainly.
The Social Security people go into the bush frequently, almost once a month they'll visit Native villages. Now we try to work closely with them, actually they rely on us. And most likely because they're a federal government agency and they have more money for travel, into this kind of a thing. But that is a possibility. If someone could go into the bush and talk to the people, I'm sure, as you're mentioning, it's very difficult to talk with the native people and get information by form, because this just, it floors them when they get something. They can't understand it. But if someone could go either from longevity bonus or from the vital statistics and go into the bush and talk to the people and accumulate, say, once a month someone's coming in, get all the people together who think they're going to be 65 and accumulate the evidence ahead of time, this would be very helpful. It is difficult for us and frustrating on our end to try to get information, and we could be much more effective if we could go out and meet the people and talk to them. I have been in the bush. I have talked to people on when we went on magistrate training program, and we've incorporated the two things, but we weren't receiving money for this particular purpose. And we have a very limited staff. We could speed up registration if that was a possibility, where there were more money into the budget for that sort of thing.
Well, the problem is that probably that the way they proposed here would be cheaper than sending the people into the bush.
But
you know, under those circumstances, rather than put the money into the bureaucracy, I'd rather go along with your position, because I think in the end it would be cheaper.
Okay, any further questions on the other section? There's one that increases the money.
Yes. Another one that's out of state.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question?
We had a presentation over here. Go ahead, Senator Orsini.
Maybe tell me what portion are of all the class of people we're talking about, natives born in rural areas, not in hospitals. You said there are in many cases there were records, in some cases there aren't records. Do you have any kind of proportion of one to the other? How many of the cases that you get are that you can readily find, as opposed to how many that are very difficult?
Well, I would say that mostly I would have to lean to the most difficult, except there are documents there, don't misunderstand me. We eventually get them. It just takes the length of time that it takes to get the document. I would say that I don't know of a case where we could not come up with a document, some kind of a document on a person. But 90% of all the people that we handle, unregistered births are Native people. The proportion to whites are very small. But they have the same problem.
That wasn't my question. My question was, what proportion, for example, take you less than 60 days to verify, as opposed to take more than 60 days?
More
what?
It would take us more than 60 days in the majority of the cases.
Majority of the cases would take you more than 60,
mm-hmm.
60 days.
Yes.
And numerically, what kind of number, how many people is that approximately?
Well, we process about 30 cases a month.
So better than 15 a month would take you longer than 2 months
yes.
to find.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm.
On page 2, section 3 under B, Marie, has that been changed and now? In other words, didn't it be 30 days for outside hospital and now it's up to 90 days on the field?
Yes,
that's all.
What's
that?
The way the law reads at the present time is that they've been out, if they're outside over 30 days, they're taken off the program until we return.
Okay, Senator Tillian has a question. Senator Tillian?
I understood the reason that we wrote this tight and didn't allow hospitalization
right.
was because we were afraid of the constitutional problems, and with maybe Marie could. I think we're endangering the whole bill by.
Okay, anybody want to comment on that?
Yeah, what was your question, Senator?
Well, the thing is that if we pay a longevity bonus to people that are outside in the hospital, do not we endanger our whole program?
Well, the way the law reads at the present time, we have never sent a check outside. It says that if they're outside over 30 days, the bonus stops, and when they return, it starts again, unless they're out over 180 days.
Well, my question was, if you send a check outside, are you endangering the whole program? I understood way early under the constitutional problem that as long as you maintain its cost of living differential and the check is only paid to a person for time spent in Alaska, you can defend it constitutionally.
Senator Tillian, Mr. Peter is here from the Attorney General's office. Perhaps you can respond to it.
Yes, Senator, we are still researching that. Could possibly have an answer for you today, but we weren't quite certain of the, we wanted to narrow your question down as to what your concern was exactly, which you just expressed. You said earlier you thought it killed the bill, and your feeling is that because the purpose of the act is to pay a bonus to people who remain in the state, that this would be defeated by paying to people who are outside the state, even for a brief period.
The argument when Mike Gravel changed the federal law was that actually this was a cost of living differential. If you pay it to anybody outside, it can't be considered a cost of living differential, and therefore it's an income. And, you know, everybody I've talked to consider, you know, that's researched it law-wise, consider that you endanger the whole bill by losing your cost of living differential.
A lot of it may depend upon the extent of it, to which I'm not prepared to say now whether 30 days would, or 90 days would or wouldn't. You're paying certain expenses if you are in a hospital, for example, or even living outside temporarily, which may be comparable to Alaskan expenses, may not be, but I say we have not completed our work on this yet. I was in conference just before this meeting this morning and was canceled because another grant was a higher priority. But we can get you an answer very quickly on that because we weren't certain as to just what Senator Tillian's concern was, although we had a general idea as to what the problem was.
Okay. I don't know how this came up, but it was
Fish
Bowl
Johnson's thing where he had his leg amputated and he was outside, and it was a pitiful case, and there is no argument about it except that to cover him you endangered everybody else in the state because you know, the
because
defense in Congress when the law was changed to allow our bonus to not be counted was that it was a cost of living differential only paid for time spent in Alaska. And so you defeat the whole purpose in which the federal waiver was granted by Congress. And whether anybody would raise it or not, I don't know, but it's a dangerous thing to play with just for
one thing. We have the federal